Well, welcome everybody to the very first Chef Life Radio live event here at The Mule. And I wanted to talk a little bit about why we're here and what we hope to achieve. I've been doing the podcast Chef Life Radio since about 2006, and it started as a drunken love letter. So I was living in Canada with a woman who would become my wife. And of course, I didn't have a work permit or anything. So I thought, what do I do with my time? Oh, I know, I'll do a podcast, as if I knew what the hell that was about. And I just got done working for a year and a half at this beautiful resort, one of the oldest resorts in North America, called The Homestead in Virginia. And it'd been the first time since I'd been a sous chef since, I don't know, 20 years. I got a call in the middle of the night. And this guy says to me, hey, dude, I just took over this resort. I really need your help. And I'm like, okay, in what capacity? Oh, well, you come be my sous chef. I'm like, I've been a sous chef 20 years, man. And at that time, I thought my life was taking a completely different direction. I thought I was going to be on stage and writing books and giving speeches and stuff like that. And so I turned to my wife, Jennifer, and said, what the fuck? Like, I thought my life was going this way, and now all of a sudden it's starting to go this way. Is this universe just fucking with me? And she said, well, you'll never know unless you go on an adventure. And I said, what do you mean by that? She said, well, it's always a yes until it's a no. I said, that got even me more confused. And what she explained was, is that when something shows up in your life, you can either continue to follow the thread or you can just bail. And by continuing to follow the thread, you'll find out whether it's a yes or whether it's a no. And so what I knew was, within 7 days, I was interviewed, processed, on property, in uniform, in my rental apartment, ready to go. And so I said, well, shit, I guess this is a yes, which didn't make any sense at the time because my wife was living in Florida and I'm living in Virginia. I'm like, this doesn't feel right. What I discovered in kind of stamping my feet a little bit and being a little bitch, Jennifer said, listen, why don't you just be where you're at and have what you have? Just be where you're at. Pour yourself into it. I love you. I'm not going anywhere. Everything's going to be fine. Just fully be present. And what I discovered was that I had kind of a hidden superpower that I'd never discovered before. As you're a chef, or as you become a chef, and you start managing people, you recognize that heavy sits the crown. Like, you bear everything. And it wasn't until I became a sous chef again that I was relieved of that duty, that I recognized that one of my superpowers was to just go around and have conversations with people all day long. So typically 125 staff members, 7 kitchens, 12 outlets. I spent most of my day running around from outlet to outlet after the chef had come through and pissed everybody off. And then I would come in there and just kind of chill everybody out. And so that's why I discovered it'd be having 1,000 conversations a day. So I had a lot of affinity for those folks that I was missing. And so I started this podcast. As I said, it was a drunken love letter back to the people that I missed. And along the way, I recognized that maybe this mode of communication might have a different use. So I started with a question, which was, two chefs given equal skill sets, why do some cooks follow one and then not the other? And they'd always say, oh, well, it's because he's a great leader. He or she is a great leader. And I never knew what that meant. I'm like, that doesn't really tell me anything. I need to know their ways of being so that I can model that. Like, do they turn left? Do they turn right? Do they do this? Do they do that? If I can see that, then I can model it and in my own mind become a better leader. And so I've been on this journey ever since then of trying to discover what it is that makes really powerful culinary leaders, because I'd spent most of my life working under shitty ones. So those of you in the audience who've been there probably can recognize that statement, because unfortunately, most of my life I learned by not doing the same thing that others had done, because they just shown up as being either very autocratic or dismissive, or worse. And I was lucky enough to have been graced with the feminine in my career. So my very first executive chef job, I had a sous chef that was a woman who bailed me out so many times, it wasn't even funny. And it seemed like everywhere I was, there was a woman of consequence in a position of authority, so that I got to really appreciate the difference that they make in an environment, especially in the hospitality industry, where and so I think it's kind of hysterical that most folks, when they think of chefs now, they think of, you know, men in authority, when in fact, it's a, just the process of making food for someone else is a very nurturing act. So some might say it's a very feminine act. Now, I probably get that when we were in caves, you know, the women took care of that kind of stuff while the men were out hunting. But I don't know when it switched between it being something that was specifically for the feminine, and now the men have horned in and the women got to play second fiddle. But you'll find that I have some very strong opinions about mental health and wellness in our industry, but equality and equality of opportunity, if not equity. Like, it's still one of the last meritocracies in the world, and you work hard, you should be able to rise. And yet there's still kind of a white wall of silence that goes on with some institutions and some chefs, where it makes it very difficult for people of color or people of different identities to attain positions of authority. But be that as it may. So I moved here in about 7-8 years ago, and I was working outside of the city. So my wife and I moved into a house in Alexander. And after we closed on the house, I left to do a 3-month stint in Austin, and she moved into the house by herself. So most often, even though I'm living here, I'm doing gigs everywhere else. And then the hurricane came. And, you know, a year plus, a couple months. And I had lived in Florida for 25 years and experienced 5 hurricanes. And it didn't occur to me until I came up here that Florida's flat. So when a hurricane comes, all you need to do is hold your breath and it's over in 4.5 hours. Here, when Hurricane Helene came, that Thursday, I was downtown having a glass of wine with a friend of mine. And I saw the shops closed up, and I'm like, come on, what are you, I've been through hurricanes, this ain't gonna be nothing. And went home that night and woke up in the next morning and went out to the back porch and saw this enormous tree just start dancing in my backyard. And I thought for sure it was gonna come down on the house. And so I wasn't prepared for what I can only describe as the violence of the storm as it coursed up and down the valleys and the Swannanoa, and we're about 0.5 mile from French Broad River and 2 miles from a little town, Marshall, right? We're right down the river from Marshall. My world got really, really small for about 4 or 5 days. My wife was out of town. It was just me and the dog. And pretty soon we were confined to like the space around the sofa. And that's where our lives existed for 4 or 5 days until the power came back on. Meanwhile, my wife is in Florida or in California going through all the feeds and getting all worked up, wondering why she can't get a hold of me. And I'm just like kind of very, very small in that moment. And it took something out of me. Like, I would say that prior to that, I was full of bravado and ready to try almost anything. And that storm kind of left me wondering, what role did I fit into the community? Now, previous to that, I'd been with a worthy organization here in Asheville called Journeyman that group mentors boys aged 12 to 18 into becoming men of integrity. And that would look like twice a year taking them up to a mountain and stripping away all their possessions and then doing a sacred theater and enacting their own hero's journey. And that, to me, was a really, really powerful experience and helped me integrate into a community that I really wanted to be a part of, meaning Asheville. And as I explained before, most of my work experience had been outside. So I was trying to figure out how to land what I do here. And so I was welcomed into that organization. And I remember how good that felt, you know, being in service to boys. You know, typically it'd be maybe 12 to 16 boys and 60 men on this mountaintop. And they're brought in the middle of the night after they've been sitting in a clearing for 4 hours. And as the sun starts dipping down, all of a sudden they could hear the drums beating. And the drums keep beating and get louder and louder and louder. And then they're brought into this circle, initiated elders. And so there's a lot of mysticism, not only in that act of standing for these boys, but I think that's rooted here in Western North Carolina in the oldest mountain range in the world, with a history of indigenous culture that goes far back than any of us really consider. So after Helene, I was trying to figure out what to do. Like, how do I, again, kind of reintegrate myself into the community? And it just so happened that another men's meeting, I hadn't been out for a year after the hurricane. I'd just gotten through a really significant back surgery. And so I'm like 2 years out of it. And I see an ad for a men's group organization that's going to be meeting at the Mule, which I'd never been to before. And I got here and walked inside and I turned around and I saw the stage and I knew that this was the place. This is the place where I wanted to do this live podcast show that I've been thinking about for a long, long time. During and after Helene, you know, most of the housing that was lost was, you know, low income to middle income housing. That was all our dishwashers, our servers. I remember a newspaper article with a guy from general manager of Mellow Mushroom downtown saying like, yeah, we can open up. We just can't serve you because there's nobody around. There's nobody to fill those positions that we didn't really pay attention to. But having grown up in the industry, I recognize that those who are in service to us very often kind of fall out of our sight. The dishwasher's in the pit and he's doing his job. And he's the last thing we think about until, of course, he calls out and then we have to work in the dish pit. So I thought, what a unique opportunity to take what I do, which is do this podcast, bring it home to Asheville, North Carolina, to the Mule, and use it as a way to not only promote some of the things that we're doing here as a hospitality community, but also to talk about some of the issues that have been going on. And I'm pretty sure that there's going to be some solutions and things that we discover here in conversation that is going to serve other communities out there. So it's part promotion, part support, and all hospitality. So I'm really happy that you guys are here. So thank you very much for being here. And since it's the first thing, the first show is never as much as you want it to be and sometimes less than what you hope, but that doesn't matter because we're here together and that's the beginning of community. So thanks. I appreciate what, for whatever reason you came out, I'm grateful that you're here. And with that, I want to invite up Paul Crescent Jr. Paul has got a really interesting story for us. Paul, sit down to make sure that your mic is on. Go ahead.
Hello.
Yeah, there you go.
Hi.
So, Pauly Boy Enterprises.
Yeah.
Sorry, a little.
Okay.
Just want to take the edge off.
Make it loud.
There we go.
Hey.
We were having a little conversation earlier, and I thought it was important to bring you up on stage because you're one of the reasons that we're here. I mean, not you personally, but certainly, sure. Why not? Oh, give us some idea of where you've been, what you've been doing.
Originally, I grew up, born and raised in New Orleans, Louisiana. I'm not a fan of hurricanes, but been through quite a few as well. It's the hurricane season.
Yeah.
Very familiar with it. Anyway, my chef career, cooking career started in Nashville, Tennessee back in the late 90s, about 27 years ago. I earned my chops there. I just started hanging out at dive bars and sports bars. And then I was thinking about, you know what? I want to try cooking. And me and some friends started having house parties.
Right.
I was cooking gumbo and red beans and rice. Like, I'm not sure how I knew how to do it, but being in my grandmother's kitchen as a little kid and the oldest grandson, helping her out constantly, kind of just stuck with me. And people were telling me, man, this is really good. This is crazy. This is like what we have when we go to New Orleans. It reminds us of New Orleans. It's like, you should work in a restaurant. You should go to culinary school. And eventually, like I said, I started working in those sports bars and dive bars just to get my feet wet and see what the, you know, see what the grind was all about, see what the buzz was. And it kind of felt good that I was doing something different and I had a little bit more independence and I had a little bit more of a direction of where I wanted to take my life. Cause I was in my mid 20s at that time. And I still was kind of flipping around ideas. I didn't even go to culinary school. I went to modeling college, graduated. I'm a professional model, but not like the runway models, you know, like catalog and print work and stuff like
right.
that.
Right. You see your hands
or your
lower calf, right? With the sock on.
Yeah. Get the collar.
And they get paid.
So I was kind of like the turning point for me. And that's when the Food Network became big.
Oh, yeah.
Anthony Bourdain's first TV show came on there, and that kind of just grabbed me. And of course, like he said, you know, he's like, don't become a cook so you can get on TV. And that's exactly what I tried to do. And then he said, you know, it's probably not going to happen. And, you know, I realized he was totally right. But I wanted to get better. I wanted to move on. And I wanted to see what fine dining was all about. Started working with some fine dining restaurants, chef operated and owned places mm-hmm. in Nashville. A couple of these folks were like Culinary Institute of America graduates, sure. French Culinary Institute, International School of Culinary Arts or something like that. They're very well established places. And so they taught me a lot, and I learned the rules. I learned what they were taught in culinary school, basically. So I did that for a while, and I ended up moving back to Louisiana for a change of scenery. I can get into it later, but there was in Nashville, the culture, and I guess, well, everywhere, the culture kind of started to get to me where it was always okay to go out and party after your shift was over.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I became an alcoholic and a drug addict and functional. I was still getting the job done. I was making it and happening, but there was a wall. I couldn't go further than where I was.
Right.
People wouldn't let me learn more or become more than what I was because they didn't want me to become a liability to their business. Because I was, you know, I was more interested in the party after work.
So you're saying that the people that you worked for understood that you were a liability and would only let you go so far because they knew at some point you were going to burn, burn it, and they didn't want to be around when that bomb went off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I was pretty much, I was self-destructing slowly but surely, burning out.
I don't know anybody else in this room that was like that.
And my dad and my stepmom had moved to Northwest Louisiana. They opened up a business. They had some cousin that they were sharing a business with, and they took it over. So I moved there for 6 years. Again, I just wanted to start over. I felt like I was turning a new leaf. I started working with some of the best restaurants in Shreveport, Bossier City area. Some of these chefs, I wanted to go to Europe and train, like in Italy or France, right. and get a job there. But I found a chef from Sicily who opened up his own restaurant, and he spent $1 million on the kitchen alone.
Right.
So I snuck in there as fast as I could. I waited for like a month for this guy. And he finally called me back. He's like, I see you have like, you got like 12 years of experience in kitchens. You want to come hang out and tell me if you like this? And I was like the only guy in the kitchen who was fluent in English. Everybody was speaking Spanish or Italian or both at the same time. And right. I was this was like the international experience I wanted, the culinary experience. And this guy has been cooking for 50 years and he was kicking my ass and I was loving it. One thing led to another. I started hopping from job to job to job. And then I moved to Charlotte in 2015.
Right.
Again, I'm running from problems. I'm running from my own self. And I can't get away from that, obviously. Got to Charlotte, started working with some big wigs, some very nice people who I'm still friends with. And they offered me, you know, they said, if you ever come back, if you need a place or a job or something like that, you'll give us a call. So I was still working through all the kitchen positions. It didn't matter to me. I just wanted to learn as much as I could. And luckily, by graces of the higher powers that be, it's like the one thing that I always wanted, that it was like, I just wanted to keep learning more. You know, I wanted to be better and better and better. And my memory is just like, it never left my memory. Like everything I learned was just like sticking to me like glue.
Right.
Especially how not to be and how not to lead a kitchen.
Right.
And how not to people like dirt.
Yeah. Don't be a dick.
Yeah.
Just don't be a dick.
Yeah, and you know, and there was times, especially the first job I had in Charlotte, I stayed in that kitchen who was dominated by women. The restaurant was owned by the pastry chef. She was hiring 75% of the kitchen was women. They were all fantastic. They were all badasses. They're all tough. I mean, they're like, you know, they would get cut and burned and you laugh it off. And I would sit there like, do you want to put a bandage on that or something? And they're just, you know, growling at me, you know, like,
well, yeah, I mean,
get out of the way.
They have to be tougher than us.
Yeah.
Right. They can't show any weakness whatsoever or everybody will shit on them. Or at least that's the way it used to be.
And I learned like the nurturing part, that part, you know, it's like, I want to feed people. I want people to enjoy food, and I want, you know, them to know the story behind it. Or maybe, you know, where did it come from? Where did this dish come from?
Listen, we just met, but what I can tell about you right now is that you're a very sensitive person. And the reason I know that is because of what you chose to do with your life, right? Mm-hmm. Anybody in the audience who's been in this industry, I can say emphatically to you that you are a kind, considerate, sensitive human being, because no other person would be drawn to this industry except for us. You know, to subvert our own needs in service of someone else, that says something. I don't necessarily know if it says something good, but I do know that, you know, I've seen a lot of people doing the pee-pee dance on the line just to get that one more plate out before they have to go to the bathroom because they're thinking about someone else as opposed to themselves. And what I know is that, taken to an unhealthy degree, putting yourself at the bottom of a totem pole, you end up there for a while, right?
Right.
Yeah. So what brought you to Asheville?
It's the 21st of October in 2017. My mom came here to evacuate Hurricane Katrina. She and a roommate had land in, or her roommate had a house and property in Weaverville. They liked it so much that they stayed. They went back and salvaged what they could, brought it up here. My sister, little sister, she showed up about 6 years later, met a boyfriend. They have a 11-year-old daughter, my niece. And, you know, then I was thinking, well, it's only 2 hours away from Charlotte. I wanted to change the scenery and see what Asheville's like. And when I got here, what I thought it would be like was nothing like what it would be like.
What'd you think it was going to be like?
I thought it was going to be like Beverly Hills.
Really?
I thought it was going to be like the Beverly Hills of North Carolina, bougie. More so. Yeah. And, you know, I heard it was like the Paris of the South.
Oh, shit.
It, you know, I didn't know anything about the Blue Ridge Mountains. I was still like just consumed with moving on and trying new things and getting some.
And so what struck you when you first got here?
The actual reason I came here was to go to rehab and get help. I went and worked in Candler on a farm for the first 9 months I was here. After rehab, it was a really nice place. So I learned how to do farming and manage some greenhouses. They wouldn't let me get in the kitchen. They said, we're not putting you in the comfort zone. We're not putting you in there.
Okay, journeyman wouldn't either because they said, no, that's your safe place.
Yeah.
You don't get to have your safe place.
We're going to train you. We're going to put you on it. We're going to give you a job that you never had before. And then you're going to learn how to do farm work and sleep here, work here. You're going to get paid minimum wage.
Right.
But we're going to get you back on your feet so you can go back out into society and start working again and do what you want to do.
Cool.
So thought the first impressions, I think we're just like, outside, wow. I mean, for the greenery and the people were saying, you know, it's kind of like a rainforest in the mountains kind of thing.
Yeah, very like, rich soil, man.
Wow. Yeah. Taking my first ride, Blue Ridge Parkway, you know, down there on this bus and then just riding through there with the people that live on the farm just to go to town. It was like, you know, it was pretty amazing. I felt a lot more at peace when I started just seeing more and more of the town. And then going downtown, my first job here was at Corner Kitchen. I didn't realize it was the busiest kitchen in town. After being out of the game for a year, hopping back in like that, and then start 50-hour weeks, it didn't last too long. But they were, like I said, there's some of those folks there too are I still keep in touch with. I've seen Joe and, you know, recently, and everything's going well. I've been back twice since the place reopened after the hurricane. I see a lot of resilience. I see a lot of similarities to reaction and actions from people here, that people from New Orleans, when natural disasters strike. I like the way the community pulled together. I like the way that people are helping and reaching out. And it was just, it was more of a wholesome feeling, you know, more of a family outside of family kind of thing.
Less transactional than in most places, right?
Like when 2020 happened, people, I didn't know where to go. I didn't know what to do. And I started writing stuff down, writing down a business plan, writing down what I'd never been an executive chef at a restaurant. I never had my own restaurant. Right. So I wrote down what it would be like, or what I think it would be like if I was to do this, because it's like one of the only positions I never held. And I want to do it. And 2021, 2020 early 2021. I was at Rosa B's. I was there right when the doors opened in 2020, when you could, it was still like takeout only.
And coming off COVID.
Yeah, coming out of COVID, and started doing pop-ups. I started becoming more and more acquainted with not only other restaurants, but restaurant owners, chef owners, all the independent restaurant owners and stuff like that. Lots of air, you know, the air Asheville people. And
Asheville Independent Restaurant Association.
Yeah.
Who we're connected with as well.
And there was also a really great group that's nationwide called Ben's Friends.
Ben's Friends, one of the leading organizations. It's peer-to-peer self-help for primarily alcoholics, but for sure. It's got a big presence here in Nashville.
Yeah. And so that all connected. I get connected with all of them. And then now it's like I go to these functions, and instead of me lately, I've been talking to, or more so it's been talking to restaurant owners and chef restaurant owners than I have actually been talking to like the cooks and the servers and the bartenders. And it just more and more, like I said, from earlier on, just remembering what I wanted. And, you know, like in 27 years ago in 1998, it's like, yeah, I want my own, I want to travel the world. I want to eat all over the world. I want to go out there and drink all over the world. I'm not drinking anymore, obviously. This is a, this is a very good mocktail, by the way. I'm in love with that drink right now. But so 2021, I just started cooking for people at their house and slowly started building a presence on social media throughout the restaurant. People that knew me were, some people were letting me do pop-ups here and there, like at the Hound. I did a pop-up at Baba Nam. I started, people were calling me and reaching out to me just, and it just kind of slowly kind of snowballed into this little business where I can like, I can.
You're more of a personal chef.
And I'm writing my own schedules. Like I don't have a job to go to today. So, well, I better find work. And I was like, well, what do I have to do? I have to marketing. I have to advertise. I have to, no one's here to helping me do this. I'm just doing it all by myself.
Bring it on your own.
Yeah. And I just realized I'm learning a whole new set of skills.
Yeah.
I realized now, you know, cooking is the part I do best. And that's only 25% of what I've got to do.
Right. Because now you're a business owner. Right.
So it's been great. And, you know, next week I'm going to be visiting Mexico for the third time in 5 years. And I've been to I've been to like 15 countries in the past 5 years because I've brought myself to that point where I work so I can go travel. And that's like my main thing. I have a good support system around me, and I've found, now, Mountain BizWorks gave me a business coach. They've enrolled me in a program to help me find the funds, the lending people, the money to get a restaurant open. And they have so many of my other now friends who also have successful businesses and restaurants in town. When the hurricane happened and everything, it was more so, I was just kind of snapped back into survival mode.
Yeah.
What do? I'm a mile and a half away from here, and my neighborhood was pretty much spared except for some trees falling down and some road blockage.
Good.
But like that little intersection where the Walgreens and the Tunnel Road and the Wendy's, I'm a mile away from that. I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm looking across the street at these giant oak trees behind my neighbor's house, and they're bending over sideways. Oh, yeah. I just thought they were going to come out of the ground and go straight through their house and then into ours next. But none of that happened. And, it was just still, it's, what are we going to do now?
what are we going to do now? So now you're about building back your private chef business. You're working on business plans.
Yeah. I had plenty of events and private chef gigs, bachelor parties from October to December last year. All got canceled. I had to give back deposits. So I had no money coming in. I was just pretty much pushing out money that was there in the first place because I had deposits and had jobs to do coming up lined up. And like everybody else, I applied for a bunch of grants, a bunch of funds to help. But since I didn't have a location for my business funds, I couldn't get FEMA because I live with somebody, my landlord. I live with my landlord, which is really cool because he was being really tolerant about the rent and everything like that. He's also in the industry, which is another good thing to have. I had a wedding that day too. I was going to do a grazing table for 100 people, and all that food was in the house. And needless to say, we had a block party. We put bonfires in the street, and I fed the neighbors for the next couple of days.
That's awesome.
So, we shared meals together with people we never talked to yet. And it was just, you know, and it was
a great way to start a conversation.
It was a great way to start a conversation. I was like, yo, you guys want something to eat? I got like sausages, a bunch of cheese. It's like, but
yeah, it, you know, so again, it really remarkable. And I will never, you know, as bad off as I thought it was, and some of my, you know, people who've never been through that kind of situation before, you know, I was still, I have to remain grateful, and that it didn't get any worse, and that, you know, we made, you know, we did what we had to do when we didn't have water for almost 2 months coming in, and we didn't have electricity for 10 days, but we managed. And my two roommates at the time, one went to Charlotte because he had friends there and he didn't want to deal with anything. And the other one, the landlord, went to the Outer Banks because he had relatives out there. So, and I had chefs from Charlotte come up here to do fundraisers and bring me into their activities, you know, so I gave me something to do too. Right. I don't know really how to explain it. It's just that I want something bad enough. It's just that what I originally wanted to do when I first got into the industry was on pause. It stopped because addiction took over. And then I got better. I just started up again where I left off. It's like my health. And, you know, it's like the mental part, the physical part. I feel like I'm 35, probably. People find it hard to believe that I'm close to 50, but I do too. My parents are like, no, you're not that old. You know, but, it's a lot of work. And I guess when you're willing to do the work, whether you like it or not, you're going to get what you want. And, and I mean, that's 25% of the work I do now is actually cooking.
So how can we support you, man, moving forward?
Well, this is doing it, man. This is doing it. If people are hearing, the best part of my career, or the best day of my career, was the day that I quit doing alcohol and drugs. The second best day of my career was when I was able to realize that, you know, I see what people are doing in the industry. I see people opening restaurants. I see people managing kitchens, creating leaders in kitchens that are going off and doing their own thing and creating more leaders. And I'm looking, I was like, you know, I can do that. I was like, I want to do that. And there has been more support now because I am being more vocal about it. And, you know, it's, you know, you can get your place, you get your position. You're just, you know, you're keeping your head down, you chop, 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 get through the service, get ready to go. It becomes more of a monotonous kind of thing. And some people become so used to that it's what they do. And sometimes, you know, if you want to do that for 25 years, go ahead and do it. It's fine. I'm just saying you don't have to. But yeah, the main thing is I've collected lots of resources. I have people across the country, some people even in other countries that I'm connected with, and like the Ben's Friends. There's people out in Colorado, people in California, people in New York, people in Florida, people in Louisiana. If anybody has any questions or wants to know more,
how to get a hold of you.
Yeah, this my email is pollyboy54@gmail.com, and I'm also on Instagram. It's all Polly or Pollyboy Enterprises. Same at Facebook, Paul G. Crescent, and Cafe Amelie, named after my grandmother. It's going to be the name of my restaurant when it opens. It's actually going to be called Amelie now because there's too many Cafe Amelies in the world, in France, in Louisiana. I don't want to be connected or confused. So with that, it's anyway. Oh, here. I had stickers made the other day.
Did you? Well, yeah. We need the stickers. There you go. Amelie. Fantastic.
Sticker. Right on. So, that's, I mean.
Polly Crescent, y'all. I want to make sure that we're giving Eileen and Emily some business. So if you guys want to take a break and refill your glasses, we'll be right back.
You're recording and everything? Do you need to hit record or is it always recording? Oh, gotcha. All right.
This is the portion of the show that scares the shit out of me. Because it's never happened before. Although I've had plenty of ideas of how to incorporate it. So I'd like to welcome to the stage my wife, Jennifer. So there's a couple different ways we could take this. We could go for the horror show stories, or, you know, Jennifer is not in the industry or of the industry. So after, I mean, it wasn't too long after we met.
But wait.
That she says to me, it sounds like you're going to war. As I was preparing to get to work. And I'm like, yeah, that's what it is. So
I get to enjoy the fruits of the industry.
You and your folks. She's from Canada, and we were up there for Christmas, I think, and I was driving back, and I actually executed New Year's Eve dinner completely by phone as I was driving back.
Yes, he was driving back to the United States.
Everything staged in the garage on sheet pans, everything.
I'm literally phoning. We're having this amazing prime rib, and I have no idea how to cook prime rib. And he's literally sending me directions by text, and then he's sending them by phone, and then he's sending them in every way. It's hilarious. And it was the most delicious prime rib made by two people, one in absentia.
Right, exactly.
I felt like your extension.
Yeah. Now, in all transparency, Jennifer is my fourth wife, but this relationship has lasted longer than all the rest of them. I guess I would start off. So what's it like being married to a chef?
That's funny. Well, as your last guest, Polly, was saying, it's an intense industry. And man, everything is intense. And I would say, what is it like being married to a chef? Interesting, because I remember having a client myself who was a surgeon. Uh-huh. And the surgeon would come home and he'd bring the war home with him.
Mm.
And there was an intensity that, so he was wondering why with his wife, it wasn't going so well, because everything had to be a certain way. Everywhere. And I would say being married to you at the beginning, I mean, not as much anymore, but there was a certain intensity about you, which has changed quite a bit. And then you came and you did some retreats for us. You were basically our chef, like Polly does, our personal chef for the retreats. And I think that changed my relationship to you around your industry, because I watched you pour so much love into everything you did. And then you were mostly feeding, almost always all women.
Right.
And they were usually the cooks in the house. So what got to happen is you got loved on big time by all these women. And you got to love on them. And there was this reciprocal exchange of just total love going back and forth. And there was some kind of weird light, I remember, going on. And just watching this light go on in your head, or at least it seemed that way to me, because I can't project on you. But after working in all these kitchens, it's so nice to just feel the love directly from people. Because when you're in the back of the house, you don't really get it fully all the time. And it was just, I could just see you remembering why you love to cook.
I think that's probably more to the point. And it's interesting, because I asked you what it was like to be married to a chef.
Oh, I haven't been married to other chefs. I've only been married to you.
That's so true.
I remember how you used to get annoyed too when you were foraying into your podcasting, which you've done such a great job because you're so passionate. And then you realize at some point, I don't know how you came across this, but I think it was after Anthony Bourdain's death that you were really upset at the rate of suicide the industry, like really upset.
So I remember when Roadrunner came out and I told you I didn't want you to come with me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't come and see this movie with me. And you're like, well, why? Why shouldn't I be there? I'm like, no, don't fucking come. And you did anyway. And the minute the movie ended, I got out and I paced in the parking lot for an hour.
Yeah.
Because it was just like the one scene that really got me with the very end was the friend of his that was a guitar player. When she said, I just don't think that he, like, got that people loved him.
Yeah, yeah.
Being in the industry for so long, you get so much smoke blown up your ass.
Yes.
By diners, you know, anybody who's trying to get something for you, that it becomes very, like, thank you becomes a completely meaningless word. That was great, chef, means nothing. Like, it just loses any power whatsoever because you hear it so often and you really, I started doubting people's authenticity when they were asking me, right? Did you ever get that experience where it's just like, oh, that's the greatest thing. And the other part of it that I didn't understand until recently is putting, like, I speak to a lot of chefs all day long. And one of the biggest things that they keep telling me is that they feel undervalued. They don't feel appreciated, which is a fucking joke to have right. Any layperson be able to appreciate everything that goes into it because they never will. They're not in my fucking clogs. They're not wearing my apron. But yet I made it their job to reflect back to me my value for a long, long time. And that's a mistake on my part because it wasn't fair for me to do that to them because then it all loses context. And when you're in a house with 15 women and you're doing breakfast, lunch, and dinner, you can't get away from it. It turns into something else. Yeah. Because to be frank, I'm kind of a big guy and there was always one person on the retreat who was triggered by me. I reminded her of the uncle who raped her or the father who dismissed her or what, like all this shit would be fucking, but you could see it looking on this person's face and like, I could not do anything except just show up and be loving and here's some food, darling. Relax.
And you're a little bit intense too. So.
Yeah, but eventually they would say things like, yeah. Oh, I never expected somebody to be that kind.
Someone so big that has tattoos, right. That da-da-da-da-da, that you're so sweet and kind.
Right. Brigade radio, yeah.
And because brigade is the like going to war.
It's a French military unit and but that's the way that they designed that particular system to work, and it works perfectly.
Your original question to me, though, was what's it like to be married to a chef?
Right.
And I don't know if that thank you thing is a chef thing. Maybe Polly can speak to this, but I can say being married to you, because people are thanking you all the time, B, you really are doing a good job, but sometimes I think when we do a good job, people thank you, but it's something you can do in your sleep. You kind of take it for granted because you could do that thing in your sleep. It's like, it's so easy. And then when people say thank you, you know, in over 30 years, it starts to get to be this thing where I've done it. Oh, it's so easy. It's so easy to make people happy, but you know, and so
you don't think it's a thing.
You don't think it's a thing because it's your natural way of being. And one of the things that is interesting as your wife and the recipient of your food sometimes is that oftentimes I have thanked you for other things that aren't related to food. And I had noticed that you actually in the past have not been terribly receptive to gratitude or very receivey, you know? And so I don't know, what do you think? Is that part of being what is that?
So what I recognize that there's this thing about dopamine. So I would work really, really hard at creating a wine dinner, let's say, and have everything go off beautifully. And as soon as that last plate goes down, I emotionally do a fucking complete nosedive over the cliff. Like I get depressed. I get irritable. Like when people come up and like, oh my God, that was the most fantastic. Yeah, whatever. Get the fuck away from me. And it's because of the dopamine addiction, because the dopamine is hitting so hard throughout that entire day and boom, 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 boom. And when that last dish goes out, you recognize that there's nothing left to service and you just go. And the addiction to the dopamine to me was at the center of all my addictions. Like I wanted that fucking hit. I wanted and to do anything that would like, what's the mechanism that's going to get it for? Is it the phone? Is it the beverage? Is it the snort? Whatever the fuck it is. It's like, that is just a mechanism to get me to the dopamine hit so that I can feel okay for a second. And then eventually, you know, the bar is closed. Now what do you do? And then you drop off the faces.
So,
I would drop off the faces.
So you and I have talked about the land of restaurants and all that kind of stuff being the land of misfit toys to some degree.
Yeah.
Right? And
no,
so
no, it is.
Sure. And
listen, the fact of the matter is that in a lot of kitchens, the average reading level is sixth grade. Even more. So you've got people from different cultures with different skill sets, with different educational levels. And you have to communicate in a way that they understand it so that they're all moving in the same direction. It takes a great deal of skill.
Yeah.
But I was working with somebody who's like, Adam, like you use too many words. Too many words. I'm like, no. I'm not gonna listen, because someone's education might be at a certain level, it doesn't necessarily mean that their comprehension is any less than.
And that has nothing to do with their intelligence either.
Exactly. I'm not going to talk down to them, but I want to be there where they're at.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So the thing that I was getting to is around like the addiction. It's so pervasive in the industry. And you get maybe, I don't know if it's like the land of misfit toys added to a very kind of addictive creative process that you can't really get anywhere else night after night after night. And then you get the dopamine hit. And then afterwards, you always say everyone meets on the back dock. Or they meet
on the back dock where the best meetings are held.
Or they meet at the Mule. Yay! They meet at the Mule.
Want to save them for us.
And they do all this stuff, but like they're off, and then they lost it. And so now they have a drink because they're trying to get that same feeling back, or cocaine, or whatever. That happens a lot too.
It's all a tool to get you to a certain place.
So how do you change that in this? That is my biggest curiosity. How does one, like, because it's definitely more people having those behaviors than the average.
So I think a lot of it for me is just an awareness of the instant gratification nature of it.
Got it.
The mechanism, it's all in the hospitality industry to me. It's like, listen, man, when you put that plate up in the window, people look back and you see that. I don't need anybody else to tell you that that plate is perfect.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It helps if someone climbs on like, hey, dude, that fucking shit kicks ass, man. But the point being is that short turnaround.
Yeah.
I have friends in the audiences who do long-term business deals with folks. You know, you could spend all year working on somebody's taxes or whatever to get to a point of fruition where it's like, this is the end result. And after working on it for 12, 15 months, you're like, okay. Like, it's what it's supposed to be.
You're doing all these covers per night.
So part of it is the nature of the beast, like understanding this is short-term satisfaction versus long-term. This is one of the only industries where you know instantaneously, or almost instantaneously, when you do a great job.
Yeah.
Other industries, I guess what I'm saying is it takes a lot longer to get that type of feedback back. And even then, sometimes it's muted. Like, I'm sure some people, like, you save them thousands of dollars and you know you did a solid for this guy. And he's like, all right, I'm going to, like, and you got to suck that up. So I think part of it is just an awareness of, like, this is what it is.
Yeah.
And that's why, for me, it's been so important to have other things in my life that are more long term.
The other thing that I noticed with you is when Anthony Bourdain died and you got really, really upset at the rate of suicide, which I think it's the same as the military's rate of suicide.
Go ahead.
And then I saw you want to do things like this. Like, I saw you, yeah, sure, you've got a business. Yeah, sure. But there is something that the switch that flipped in that instant for you, where you were like, we need to change the culture of this industry. This needs to be I need to be a part of the cultural shift in this industry. And you could say all the things about why we're at the Mule, and which the Mule is a great place. And you could say that, you know, you're doing it for business reasons. You could say that too. But I know at your core, this is a much bigger deal than that. This is like, where do we go to have these conversations? Where do we go to have these chats? And to me, given what I do for a living, I resonate with that part of your heart where you're like, what can we do to change the very context in which this industry happens? And that's what I appreciate about how a switch flipped for you.
Now, what I can tell you is that it started before Anthony Bourdain died, but it used to really fucking piss me off when I'm in my Facebook feed and there's a picture of a young chef and the line is, gone too soon, can I get a herd? Person will be like, you got that herd? How many can I get in all day? Or whatever the fucking topic is, but herd means I got it. And it used to piss me off because it was like, How many motherfuckers are just standing around waiting for this to happen?
Yeah.
Like, you knew the guy was in trouble.
Yeah.
And you didn't fucking say anything. Like, when's the last time you had a conversation with him? Is it okay enough for us to just stand around and wait for it to happen, knowing that it's not an impossible, a surety, but it's like, you know when people are at risk.
Well, that's
I know when people are at risk. Yep. And for me to just stand around and not do anything to me is unconscionable. Like, and then when Anthony Bourdain died, I almost fucking went insane. I'm like,
right,
motherfucker, because he was out.
Yeah.
Like, we used to look at him as like a hero because he had got out of the fucking grind and was living this fucking amazing life. And what I didn't understand is, once you build the fucking beast, it must be fucking fed.
Yep.
And he didn't know how to fucking get out.
Yeah.
He had a chance twice.
Yeah.
A chance.
Yep.
And so ultimately it comes down to us as a junkie will. So it's like, we become addicted to these patterns of behavior and ways of life to our detriment. And I got an email after Anne Burrell killed herself because suicide.
Yeah.
She lost her show on the fucking Food Network. And so she was making it up that, oh my God, now I get to do what I've always wanted to do, was improv. And so she had gone to an improv class, and her first night doing improv was the night before she.
And the thing about this is that I've watched you work with, there's one particular person that worked at in Virginia with you,
mm-hmm.
who.
Still, I still with,
and I love that guy. And I know you saved his life through coach. I'm not even saying there's an answer, but I love that that's in the background of everything. Like, I get the inside scoop because I live with you, that it's in the background of everything you do is like, let's empower people. And that's why you work one-on-one with people. And to me, that's like,
so
that's the shit.
So 2 days after Anne Burrell passed away, I got a text from somebody who I know, a fellow chef, who says, I know her. This is fucking bullshit. I know she killed herself. Then that information hadn't come out yet. And he was right. And he was like, I'd never seen this guy this mad before.
Mm.
And I don't know if it was like being mad at Anne for making the decision that she did. I'm absolutely clear that there's no way any of us can absolutely know what was going on in those last few desperate moments of despair.
Yes.
Which I can, even saying it's despair is bullshit too, because I know some people like Hunter S. Thompson. When Hunter S. Thompson was ready to go, he was ready to go, and no one was going to take him out except himself.
Yeah, it wasn't despair.
It was like, go. I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm tapping out. I would consider it a privilege to be able to say it. You know, I lost. We'd never lost another one on my watch.
Right.
Because to me, it's like, do they have access to the information? Do they have access to opportunity? Does their voice matter? Do they know that?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Those are just the very few things that matter. Like, yes, your voice matters. Here's access. Here's opportunity. If you're looking for a roadmap, this might be it. It might not be true for you, but just wait.
Well, that's why I was thinking.
Just wait a minute. Just take a deep breath.
Yeah. That's why I was thinking about Asheville and like how hard that time must have been when everybody, poly feeding like 100 people's worth of food. I mentioned, at least like the universe said, okay, people are going to be like, this is like a gift, right?
Yeah.
I feel like Asheville is just coming back. I don't know if you feel that way, but it's just coming back. And I feel like this is something that can breathe life. This is such an amazing place. And I feel so excited. The hurricane, even though, bless everyone who went through such a hard time and is still doing that, I just feel like the turning point that you made within yourself feels like a parallel turning point to everyone coming back. Do you know what I mean?
I'm
excited for the industry here.
And I'm not. So, yeah, I mean, there's a certain amount of tourist population that hasn't recovered and volume of dollars. But to me, what means more to me than that is having a community that serves one another, right? And I know that there's some very, very strong restaurateurs and chefs out there, and they're doing wonderful things. And yet I'm like, how can we serve one another? How can we take care of like making sure that there's fair wages, that there's fair housing? Like, there's all kinds of issues the chef suicide thing, like it's someone else is going to come along and fix that for us. It's not a big deal. You don't worry about it.
Exactly.
Like someone else will take care of it. And the fact of the matter is, this is our fucking mess.
Yes.
And I mean this generally within the community of chefs. This is our fucking mess, man.
Yeah.
Like the culture and everything that exists,
yeah,
you know, is our fucking fault. I consider myself part of the problem, but that's why I want to be part of the solution moving forward.
Yeah,
like saying,
I feel
there is another way to do this. There can be another way to do this. I mean, it's what I teach, it's what I coach, because I've seen the difference for myself and I've made so many mistakes. The point that I was trying to make about Anne Burrell is that I got this email over LinkedIn from the president of the Research Chefs Association who said, do you think it's time to talk about this? I'm like, what are you talking about? It's like, well, our national conference is going to be coming up next year. And some board members are thinking that maybe suicide is not a great topic to have. So in March, I'll be going to Denver to do the Research Chefs Association show to do a topic called I Got 8 Minutes.
Yay.
Which I just found out yesterday, which is a takeoff of the Simon Sinek little snippet. He found out through his third party that one of his friends was having a really difficult time. And he went back to that friend and said, hey, I thought we're friends. How come you didn't tell me? And she said, well, I did. Like, what do you mean? She said, well, I asked if you wanted to go out for a cup of coffee. Uh-huh. He's like, well, so it turns out that research proves that talking to somebody who cares, who can be empathetic with you for 8 minutes will actually change your brain waves such that you might not necessarily feel so desperate after those 8 minutes. And so they made a commitment to one another that if they're ever in a difficult spot, all they have to do is call up and say, hey, you got 8 minutes? And so the president just got up, ordered all these buttons that says, do you have 8 minutes?
That's awesome.
And I was kind of weirded out by the fact that I was the first one he thought about when he came up. Like, I never came in as, like, I didn't think that this would be a topic that I would be so closely aligned with.
Yet.
That, you know, I'm happy to serve that, but you know, I didn't think that my notoriety was going to be around, you know, mental wellness and suicide prevention, but I guess
yet you're on the, aren't you on the advisory committee of the what's the name of the,
I don't know,
come on,
several
you
other
mention them, they're awesome.
Yes, there's the Burn Chef Burn Chef project that's doing great work.
Yeah.
There's Chow out there, I love, because they do these really odd Zoom meetings. It's a hospitality organization, peer-to-peer. It's the only organization that, to my knowledge, has started out as a pure back-of-the-house, peer-to-peer support group. And now it's front-of-house, back-of-the-house. They do Zoom meetings once a week. And on Wednesday nights, they do a men's-only Zoom meeting that is so fucking awesome, man. It's just like being in a men's group. And it's in the hospitality industry. And everybody's talking the same language. It's like, holy shit, man. That's powerful stuff. 8 o'clock. Yeah. 8 o'clock Eastern time on Wednesdays. So I guess that's what it's like being married to me.
It actually is. You have a tremendous amount of passion. It pervades every area of your life. Even when we're doing the kitchen.
We're not going to bring up the kitchen, are we?
It's like, I love renovating kitchens. I've renovated two in my life. And I love it.
She doesn't know that I built 20 of them.
It's a thing to renovate a kitchen together. I never worked in the restaurant industry. I was never a waitress. I was never a waiter. I was never any of those things.
We won't hold that against you.
An aerobics instructor. So that was my...
Back in the Jane Fonda days.
That was my part-time job instead of being in the food industry. I have, through you, I think this was the last way to answer your question. Through you, I have gotten to know the restaurant industry and I have fallen in love with people I don't even know who are in such an intense atmosphere, but they're creators and these are the people that are putting food in the mouth of the masses. And it's like teachers, you know. I mean, that's a whole other thing. We spend so much time in school. Well, guess what? We spend so much time eating. We literally take nourishment from people who we don't even meet,
right,
that are putting things in our face that we completely forget. And to me, watching you on our retreats feed the people that are on our retreats and see the reciprocity when people are actually face to face with you, I'm like, huh, all the people in the back of the house are not getting that. They are not getting that. And so that's what I fall in love with. That I have a big heart. I'm like, whatever you're going to do to support the industry, I'm like, yeah, do that. Because I'm all for people having a great life and feeling fulfilled.
Thank you very much, Jennifer Hoff.
Thank you very much, Chef Adam Lamb.
You like that, didn't you?
Yes.
I want to thank everybody for coming out for the very first Chef Life Radio Live. It's been a lovely, warm audience. Great location at the Mule. Eileen and Emily, and don't want to forget Miranda. Thanks for having us, Jacob. Look forward to being back on the third Sunday of the month. That'll be November 19th. So thank you very much for everybody.
Woo-hoo!